This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in German Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Leah Greenberg. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Caroline Kita about her book, Jewish Difference and the Arts in Vienna, Composing Compassion in Music and Biblical Theater, published by Indiana University Press in 2019. Welcome to the podcast, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Leah. Glad to be here.
So Caroline Kita is Associate Professor of German and Comparative Literature at Washington University in St. Louis. She received her PhD from Duke University, and her scholarship focuses on German and Austrian culture in the 19th and 20th centuries. Caroline's interests include aesthetic philosophy, music and literature, drama and sound studies. Her recent work focuses on the soundscapes and radio dramas by Ingeborg Bachmann, Ilse Eichinger, Günter Eich, and Heinrich Boll, among others. Caroline is also co-editor with Jennifer Kipczynski of a volume of essays entitled The Arts of Democratization, Styling Political Sensibilities in Postwar Germany, forthcoming with University of Michigan Press in 2022. Her articles have appeared in the German Quarterly, the Journal of Austrian Studies, and more. And Caroline has studied at the University of Vienna, the University of Potsdam, and the University of Duisburg-Essen. She's been the recipient of numerous grants, including the Fulbright Grant to Austria, and she's also served as faculty fellow at the Center for the Humanities at Washington University in St. Louis. And that now brings us to Caroline's newest book, which brings together philosophy, Bible, music, and the politics of the day in Vienna around the turn of the century. So I wanted to start by asking if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about what brought you to this particular project. It's something that you touch on briefly in the introductory pages of your book as well.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I became interested in these sort of intersections of music and literature, I guess, very early on in my studies. I have played music from a young age. I played the viola and the piano. And my first real deep engagement with the music of Gustav Mahler was during a study abroad program in Vienna, my junior year of college. And I had chosen to go to Vienna primarily for music, to play viola, play in chamber groups, and take lessons. And in the course of another course that I was taking while I was there, I got to know Mahler's work a little bit better. I was asked to write a paper on his Third Symphony. And that was the first time I stumbled upon the figure Siegfried Lippiner, who also plays a role in my book. And when I returned to my home institution, I went to my German professor and said, I want to write a thesis about Siegfried Lippiner. And he told me, I have no idea who that is, but you should find out. And that kind of steamrolled that project. So already from an early age, I ended up writing a senior thesis on Mahler's Second Symphony and its sort of philosophical inspirations, and Lippiner played a small role there. But then I applied for a Fulbright grant to go back to Austria and really try to delve more into this relationship. So I had a year in Vienna studying at the university and working a little bit in the archives there. And then that then became part of my dissertation project. So the core of this book really began with an interest in music and literature and this unique friendship and intellectual relationship between a very well-known composer and a very little-known poet philosopher. When it came to, after I finished the dissertation and it came to sort of conceiving it as a book, I had already known from early stages of the project that the questions, the things that most drew me to Lippiner and Mahler's works, these intersections of music and narrative, the grappling with questions of religious and cultural identity, these were concerns that were resonating much more broadly in this period and were, I was noticing, emerging with particular acuity in the works of other poets and composers of Jewish descent. And so I really wanted to, when it came time to write the book, to expand on that and to bring these figures into conversation with other contemporaries. And so that's how Schoenberg and Richard Bierhoffmann and Stefan Zweig became a part of the project.
Wonderful. And so could you first perhaps lay out for listeners the sort of core thesis of the book, and then maybe expand on two very central themes which you talk about in relationship to music and the role that music can take, and that is the relationship between compassion and community.
Of course, yeah. So the book explores how compassion, as both a philosophical or ethical precept and as an aesthetic discourse, sort of converged in discourses in late 19th and early 20th century German culture, and particularly in Vienna at the turn of the century. And it explores the works of two composers, Mahler and Schoenberg, and three poets, Lippiner, Bierhoffmann, and Zweig, all of Jewish descent, who turn to the text of the Hebrew and Christian Bible to compose dramatic, musical musical and dramatic works that thematize this idea of compassion. And I mentioned it as both a philosophical and aesthetic discourse because it was drawing on the concept of compassion. In German, the word is Mitleid, literally suffering with, this idea of compassion as a overcoming of difference, a moment of connection between self and other. And also as a key aesthetic discourse. So compassion also becomes a key term in the theater of 19th century Germany as describing the moment of connection between the audience and the performers on stage, this sort of crystallization, the emotional connection in which one sees a dramatic work and feels that the story being portrayed is one's own story. And these are, so compassion is from its very core, both as a sort of ethical principle and in the aesthetics of the theater, very much connected to moments of community. And what I was so drawn to when I was looking at these works of biblical theater and music drama and symphonies of this time by Jewish writers and composers is how this idea of compassion was centrally at the core, and particularly in a constellation of responding to or overcoming moments of Jewish difference. So in all of these works, not only were they drawing on sort of biblical texts, but core stories that were about moments of conflict or otherness in the Bible. Cain and Abel, Jacob and Esau, the lone prophet Jeremiah. And so I wanted to explore more about how compassion might have been understood by these writers and authors as a way of creating community and as a way of responding to what they saw as a sort of co-opting of this discourse of compassion, which is really meant to overcome otherness, as a way of isolating or othering Jews in discourses of this time. So there was, from writers such as Arthur Schopenhauer and writers and composers like Richard Wagner, a popular conversation about compassion as being a particularly German or Christian characteristic, but Jews were incapable of compassion, that their devotedness to the law, to Jewish law, made them pure rationalists, incapable of feeling compassion. So I was so curious about how this idea of the uncompassionate Jew might have been at the core of these works and as a mode of overcoming that to create new modes of community in this time of really deep political and cultural fragmentation.
And I was wondering too, you mentioned that you'd started this as a dissertation project, and obviously that it takes quite a bit of time to then to develop that into a book project. I was wondering how perhaps your thought and contextualization of the issues at stake perhaps evolved over time through different contemporary issues of compassion and community and the othering of people within and without our perceived communities.
Yeah, I mean, as I was writing this, it became the idea of compassion was always lurking. It's very present in Mahler's in the text that he chose to set to music, and that in his description of his symphonies, and also clearly a key term for Lippinner. So that had always been lurking in the background. But it really came to the fore when I brought these other writers and composers into conversation, and that it struck me as such an important topic to be reading and thinking about in this moment, you know, even 100 years later or more, about how art can bring together people of such different mindsets and personal persuasions, about how the power of art to forge these connections, and how art is always about challenging and rethinking ways of seeing and being in the world. And I just felt like this these kind of case studies really offered an interesting way of thinking about that in a past cultural moment that resonated in a very strong way for me today.
And you mentioned the different figures that you focus on, such as Mahler, such as Arnold Schoenberg, Bear Hoffmann, and Stefan Zweig. And of course, the first figure you mentioned was this very much less known figure, Siegfried Lippener, who also had an influence on Wagner. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about your path to uncovering more about Lippener, and how you were able to piece together his correspondence and his role in the intellectual and musical life of Vienna at the time.
Sure. Yeah, it was a strange process, a difficult one, and involved a lot of digging and a lot of luck. But I, as I mentioned, I stumbled upon him when I was reading about Mahler, and he's mentioned as a sort of minor figure in a lot of the biographies of Mahler and writings on his works. But when I set out to really figure out who he was, I encountered a lot of challenges, because he doesn't have a Nachlass or archive to turn to. He was born in Galicia in the Habsburg area of Poland in 1856, came to Vienna as a young man, and seems to have sort of raised himself on his own. But he was recognized early on as a very bright intellectual, very engaging public speaker, very intelligent, very drawn to the ideas of Nietzsche. And many of his contemporaries saw him as sort of the premier interpreter of Nietzsche's writings in Vienna. And this is when he was only 18 years old. He kind of created the circle around him at the University of Vienna, where he would hold speeches and interpret a lot of these ideas about art and redemption. I'm thinking here very of early Nietzsche's writings, such as The Birth of Tragedy, and of Wagner's aesthetic philosophies as well. So he wrote and spoke quite prolifically, but then his writings seemed to have disappeared. And one of the challenges of this was trying to piece that together. So I found, you know, in Mahler's writings, some letters that were left of theirs, although many of those have somewhat disappeared or potentially were destroyed by Mahler's wife, Alma, who had a notorious, she and Libiner were notorious enemies. But there were some letters there. I was able to piece it together from other contemporaries and mutual friends of Mahler and Libiner, such as the conductor Bruno Walter, who had published his memoirs and writes quite a bit about Libiner. Libiner was connected to, he went to the same gymnasium as Freud, high school as Freud. So there was mention of him in Freud's writings. He had a correspondence with Nietzsche, and then most famously with Wagner. Libiner was invited to Bayreuth by Wagner and was in something of an interview for him to be the sort of mouthpiece or spokesperson for the Bayreuther Blätter, for Wagner's sort of journal. But he kind of butted heads with Wagner at this meeting, and their falling out, indicated a kind of shift in trajectory for Libiner's career. But he was connected to all of these interesting people. So a lot of the work was just digging and trying to find who knew him and how to kind of put this together. I was also able to track down his last living relative, his grandson, who was living in Sweden, and I was able to interview him and find out a little bit more. From what I can tell, the family fell into financial hardship and many things were sold. Some things were destroyed by Libiner himself because he was a very critical of his own work and certain things he didn't want to be published. But then also in the process of my researching him, things popped up. So there was the original manuscript of a dramatic poem that he wrote when he was only 16 years old, appeared at a flea market in Graz and was rediscovered. So it is my hope that there may be more of Libiner's writings out there. But what I was able to put together was based on, some correspondence that I could find, anecdotes from friends and mutual acquaintances, and then the few works that were published, and a few dissertations on him from the early 1930s. So he's a very fascinating figure and very, misunderstood and not known today.
Mm-hmm. Coming to his own works that you were able to look at, I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about regarding the theme of compassion and reversing notions of Jews in Viennese society. What were some ways in which he reversed common anti-Semitic stereotypes, and perhaps how that also influenced the works that you talk about later in the book?
Sure. So Libiner he was very interested in this idea of compassion, of the theater as providing a new space, supplanting the church in some ways as this new space of community and of rediscovering the deep sort of inner spirituality of all humanity. And many of his writings focus on this desire to rediscover these connections, to rediscover what he called a religious spirit, but it was something that would be found outside of the church, this sort of deep interconnection across humanity. A number of these ideas were articulated in different ways by figures such as Wagner and Schopenhauer and Nietzsche. And Libiner, but actually, interestingly enough, some of these particular writings about critiques of religion that many of us know today from Wagner's essay, Religion and Art, from 1880, were actually found in Libiner's sort of famous treatise from 1878. It was a speech that he gave at the University of Vienna on the rediscovery of religious elements in the present times. And he published this work. This is what inspired the invitation to Bayreuth to speak to Wagner. And then 2 years later, many of these ideas reappear in Wagner's writing. So there's an interesting kind of connection there. But in the book, what I do talk quite a bit about this sort of larger philosophical understanding that Libiner had. But I'm interested particularly in how he tried to translate that to the stage. He wanted to compose a tetralogy of dramas, and here, recalls Wagner's Ring of the Nibelungen, that tetralogy of music dramas. And Libiner wanted to do something similar, sort of epic, dramatic tetralogy, but he was going to call it Christus, and it was going to be inspired by these texts from the Bible, but actually beginning with the prelude with the book of Genesis, with Adam. And really, it's called Adam, but the story is really about the struggle of Cain and Abel. And it, what I talk about in the book is how, you know, this text has been almost completely forgotten, but when it was first read and reviewed, it was performed once in Dresden, that it was seen as, many people saw it as just a sort of repurposing of Wagner's ideas. And even to the extent these kind of anti-Semitic stereotypes about the uncompassionate Jew, and the figure of Cain seems to embody many of these characteristics. He's sort of described as driven by kind of cold reason instead of feeling. He's a strict adherer to the law. He's seen as the other in this text to his brother Abel, who is sort of this, you know, driven by emotion and is deeply in tune with nature and the world around him. And, you know, this seems to be just sort of the tragic story of the downfall of Cain. But what struck me as so interesting is that Cain is actually the most interesting and contradictory and complex character in the text. I mean, even as he seems to embody these sort of stereotypes, he's constantly pushing against them. In fact, he's a figure who is struggling with his faith, who's continually asserting the hypocrisy of those who wish to judge him, you know, there's a kind of critique here in Cain's writing about the hypocrisy embedded in organized religion, but also in philosophical and aesthetic theories such as Schopenhauer's and Wagner's that lean heavily on Christian ethics, and that would isolate or ostracize the Jew as other, as incapable of compassion. And Cain's monologues are very much about pleading for compassion, about this sort of an inner struggle of a wanting to a desire to belong, to be seen as a child of God. And I was struck really by this emotional depth of this figure. And he does commit the grave sin of killing his brother, but he is really a figure in crisis. He is coded Jewish, but the question, and by coded Jewish, I mean, it seems to evoke these stereotypes, but his questioning soul really embodies these struggles of modern humanity, and that this story is the launch pad for this larger trilogy of biblical dramas was something that I found really striking, and that resonated in interesting ways with what I was hearing in the text of Mahler's symphonies that were also seemed to be posing very similar questions. So that was sort of the starting point for my book.
And that perhaps makes a great transition then to the next chapter, in which you focus on Mahler. And it's therefore interesting, you've already mentioned Liebner's influence on Wagner, that Liebner also had influenced Mahler himself as well. So could you tell us a bit more about their interactions and how that finds resonance in Mahler's work?
Yeah, sure. So Mahler, they first met in, I'd say, assumed around 1878. They were both at the University of Vienna at the time. They met through a sort of a student club intellectual association called the Pernersdorfer Circle, and where Liebner was already something of a leading figure, and had a number of mutual friends and engagements during that early period when Mahler was studying in Vienna. Their correspondence is, as I mentioned, somewhat fragmented, but they seem to have remained in very close contact until around 1902, when Mahler married Alma, and his wife Alma, and I mentioned earlier that there was a lot of animosity between Alma and Liebner, and this led to a break between the poet and composer for a period of almost 8 years. They only reconciled in 1910, which is shortly before they both died, actually, in 1911, Mahler of a heart condition and Liebner of cancer. So a kind of interesting and dramatic friendship that spanned their lives. But in this period, between the late 1870s to around the turn of the century, they corresponded with the composition of Mahler's first four symphonies. And these are the works that are most, can be described as most narrative. So they had, he wrote programmatic descriptions for these works. They also, the second, third, and fourth symphonies all include songs, so texts or choruses, a text that was set to music integrated into the song structure. So there's a number of interesting texts to read, if you will, when studying these early symphonies. And what I discovered when looking at the text that Mahler set to music, the descriptions he gave about the meanings of these symphonies, and all of them circle around similar ideas about individual struggles of longing for for redemption, for a sense of alienation and reconciliation. These are themes that are kind of explored in different ways in each of these symphonies. And the language that Mahler uses, either from the text that he chose or even certain texts that he wrote and then set to music, echo similar ideas in Lippinner's dramas that were composed around the same time. And so in looking very closely at these correspondences, I started to piece together the kind of conversation that they might have been having about this desire for compassion, seeing compassion as the core of a new religious spirit, something that seemed to transcend a traditional Jewish or Christian faith, but that would respond to a particular sort of crisis of their the world that they were living in that moment. And there's a number of different ways that these references appear. So some of the most obvious ones are, for example, the title of the first movement of Mahler's Second Symphony is Totenfeier, or Funeral Rites, which was the title of an epic poem by the Polish poet Adam Mickiewicz that Lippinner translated into German at the same time that Mahler was composing his movement. So there's some of these connections are closer, but others I only found from looking very closely, such as the lyrics that Mahler composed for the finale of the Second Symphony that echo the final lines of Lippinner's or key lines in Lippinner's epic poem Prometheus Unbound from 1878. So there's a way in which they were using a similar language and drawing on very similar ideas. In terms of the mentorship relationship in particular, a lot of this can be parsed together from these anecdotes of their contemporaries. So as Natalie Bauer-Leschner, who was a musician and close friend of both the poet and composer, who chronicled much of the early development of the genesis of Mahler's early symphonies, mentions Lippinner multiple times about conversations that the two of them had about these ideas. And so so I kind of pieced together this relationship through these different sources.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Fascinating. And another relationship that you talk about with these authors and composers is the relationship to Judaism itself, both personally and sort of conceptually. So I was wondering if you could tell us more about the famous composer Schoenberg's relationship to Judaism and how his works that you talk about, Totentanz der Prinzipien and Die Jakobsleiter, work to challenge ideas of Jewish difference.
Yeah, Schoenberg's relationship to Jewishness is so fascinating, and there's so many chapters to it. He was born to a Jewish family, was descended on his mother's side from prominent Jewish cantors in Prague. He converted to Protestantism when he was 24, although he soon seemed to turn away from any kind of organized religion. He was very interested in the first decades of the 20th century in mysticism and theosophy. He was reading a lot of the sort of avant-garde writings of Emanuel Swedenborg, August Strindberg, Honoré de Balzac. So he was really interested in a more sort of open-ended idea of mysticism at this time. And then his awareness, you might say, of Jewishness or his sort of reawakening to Jewishness started in the early 1920s, around the time when, in the middle really of when he was composing this oratorio, Die Jakobsleiter, when he was subject to overt discrimination. He talks about an experience he had in a summer resort in Austria, in which he first became truly aware of his Jewish otherness, even despite his conversion. And over this period of the next, throughout the 1920s until 1933, when he eventually converted back to Judaism, he was increasingly interested and engaged with Jewish texts and Jewish faith, and also with Zionist politics. But in this book, I was interested in exploring these two works that he wrote before this more overt or conscious return to the Jewish faith. And that is, so I mentioned this oratorio Die Jakobsleiter, which remained unfinished at his death, and a relatively unknown monodrama called Totentanz der Prinzipien that he wrote around the same time, in the late 19-teens. And in these works, so one a monologue or a monodrama, the other sort of a fragment of an oratorio, I mentioned they've often been read in the context of this avant-garde spiritualism that he was exploring at this time. But what he was also reading at this time, Otto Schopenhauer's Essay on Religion, which was a text in which the philosopher articulated an argument that Judaism was fundamentally incompatible with his own philosophy of compassion. And thanks to the incredible archive at the Arnold Schönberg Center in Vienna, and this, they've digitized so much of Schönberg's writing, but even his own copy of Schopenhauer's text and the notes that he wrote in the margin, I was able, and they're dated, so I was able to see really what he was reading while he was composing the libretto for this oratorio and for this monodrama. And in it, he's really grappling with Schopenhauer's depiction of Judaism as uncompassionate. And then when I looked to the text of these works, I continually saw correspondences with these images. So both the monodrama and the oratorio articulate a struggle with the idea of the Jews as the people of the law. And this sort of characterization of the law as incompatible with compassion, and both express a sort of desire to overcome these oppositions. And what I describe in the chapter is how both, not only in the musical innovations that Schönberg was developing at this time, and Die Jakobsleiter is a sort of turning point in his own compositional strategy. He was starting to develop what would become known as this 12-tone system of music, a form of music that moves away from the hierarchies of tones that really shape the Western tonal music system up to this point. If he was sort of rethinking a musical language, he was also rethinking a poetic language to try and overcome these kind of dichotomies of Jew and Christian, the people of the law, the people of compassion, you might say. So I describe this principle of polyphony as embodying not only Schönberg's musical ideas at this point, but also the language of these really sort of unique, fragmented, dramatic texts that he was writing at this time.
And so you talk about the disruption of existing paradigms. And one paradigmatic figure is, of course, Wagner. And so he's a recurring presence throughout your book. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about the role of Wagner's legacy for each of these figures that you talk about, in particular for Richard Berhoffmann. How is he both a model and an object of critique in these works?
Sure. Yeah, Wagner is, I talk in my book about this sort of the Wagnerian trauma that seems to resonate with each of these writers. And that's what I mean by that, and that's a term used by Michael Steinberg, but this idea that the way that Wagner's, both his aesthetic legacy and his sort of larger philosophical views formed it was a conflicted legacy for writers of Jewish descent. I don't think, you can't ever claim that they were unaware of it, But there seems to be a challenge or that I noticed when I was approaching each of these works with figuring out how to describe this relationship, how one could want to model, to create epic dramatic works, to believe in the sort of ideas behind Wagner's works in terms of aesthetics, while rejecting the very divisive rhetoric of particularly anti-Semitic rhetoric that appears in his written text, but also in his operatic works as well. And so what I noticed in each of these works was this really interesting and delicate negotiation of this. Certainly for Mahler and Schoenberg, compositionally, Wagner was a huge figure for how he sort of redefined orchestral works. I mean, Mahler never composed an opera, but his symphonies, he reimagined the genre of the symphony almost to be like a music dramatic work. You know, you can see him sort of struggling in terms of genre there. And same with Schoenberg as well. And it becomes even more prevalent perhaps in Schoenberg's later opera, Moses and Aaron. But I was interested in exploring how these earlier works might also have been a attempt to sort of confront Wagner's sort of musical legacy while sort of spinning this, this challenging way that he really isolated or discounted a Jewish contribution to music. He really saw Jews as incapable of creating true music. And so, you know, how did they handle that legacy? Lippinner, of course, had sort of the most direct engagement with Wagner. And with Beer Hoffmann is interesting. Unlike some of the other writers, he wasn't as enamored with Wagner as a person. He went to Bayreuth and was kind of dismissive, actually, of the experience. And yet he decided to compose a tetralogy of biblical works, inspired, in his case, not by Germanic myth, but by the Hebrew Bible. And so you can't help but see this as a sort of answer in many ways. And it was also received. If you look at reviews of the work, many of it refer to it as a Jewish Nibelungenring. You know, so there was this is clearly something that was functioning in the background. But what I think is so interesting in Beer Hoffmann's work, and I focus in the book primarily on Jacob's Dream, which is the prelude or the first work of the tetralogy, and that it's drawing on certain ideas from Wagner. So the idea of a mythic subject, here it's the Hebrew Bible. Compassion is a key theme in the work, but it's not, you know, if we look to another Wagnerian example like Parsifal, this is not, his protagonist Jacob is not this, you know, compassionate fool. He's not magically possessed with the ability to feel with or understand others. It's actually a struggle. And that's really the topic of, or the theme of the play. It's about Jacob coming to understand compassion through his encounters with various others, a pagan slave, his brother Esau, who embodies in many ways these ideas of Christianity in this moment, or a sort of Christian other, and then the fallen angel Samuel, who is the sort of gives a sort of vision of the future of the Jewish people. And Jacob has to, in each of these confrontations, he's led to a deeper understanding of his own identity. He expresses compassion and solidarity with these others. But this is it doesn't sort of magically happen or we're led there. It's through a process of confrontation, of dialogue. And so I was really interested in how, you know, Beer Hoffmann took this sort of model of epic drama from Wagner and really reimagined it to a space of questioning and struggling and coming to terms with and thinking through what a modern Jewish identity might be.
And that brings us nicely then to one of the last authors or figures you look at, which is Stefan Zweig, who is quite well known for his negotiation of what a modern Jewish identity could be. So I was wondering if you could expand more on how Zweig's work engages with notions of hybridity or a dual affiliation, or even transcends a commitment to these sorts of categories altogether.
Yeah, like Schoenberg and Beer Hoffmann, Zweig was also looking for a language or way of conceptualizing the significance of Jewish culture for his own life, for European culture more broadly. And he was very interested in overcoming this language of Jewish difference. So I had just mentioned about Schoenberg's turn to this idea of polyphony as a way of overcoming this idea of Jewishness as other or them to a Christian or German us. And for Berhoffmann, the way to sort of transcend these dichotomies was to turn to dialogue, this sort of dialectical process of confrontation, alienation, reconciliation. And for Zweig, he kind of came up with his own language for it, which he referred to it as discursion, which he connected with the idea of hovering between two poles. So it was this kind of a sense of identity that was always in flux. And I think it's interesting, you know, you mentioned hybridity or dual affiliation. I think this is a kind of transcendence of those ideas. It's a sense of Jewishness that is very much, it's very much about being in flux. And there's a reason why I think music is the language that Zweig turns to conceptualize what this Jewish identity might be, that it is in a constant sort of movement between consonants and dissonance, cacophony and euphony. It is that struggle embodied within it is actually, for Zweig, the unique contribution of Jewish culture to European, you know, to the modern European self. And he was very much interested, Zweig's whole oeuvre is about transcending the national and the chauvinistic ideas and thinking about these larger collective identities. And what's interesting is in his biblical drama, Jeremias, which is often been read as a pacifist book, a play. He wrote it in the final years of the First World War. But it's also very much about the poet's own kind of coming to terms with what his Jewish identity meant for him and how, what were those unique attributes that might sort of provide a template, if you will, for where, you know, how humanity could come together in the wake of such a crisis as the First World War. So this biblical drama became a way for Zweig to really work through that. And he, I mentioned this, also musical forms being central to that. Here, even more so than the sort of music drama, really Zweig was leaning on the concept of the oratorio. So there's interesting resonances actually with what Schoenberg was doing in Die Jakobsleiter. With Zweig, his play actually in its form and structure recalls at many points different structural formations of the oratorio and also resonates in different ways with Jewish musical life with the cantor, call and response, and so on. So music became sort of the language for him to work through and identify this unique contribution of Jewish culture to European modernity.
And what interests me as well about all of these authors you talk about is their engagement with different types of arts. So poetic, the music, theatrical. And I'm interested in the intersections of the arts, both within your book and sort of on a meta level in terms of your process working interdisciplinarily. So I was wondering if you could perhaps reflect on how this intersection of literature, history, philosophy, and musicology informed you as a scholar and informed your process in this project? And sort of what are some of the challenges and rewards of this interdisciplinary work? It's very clear that you had to do a lot of very intense archival work, very historical, have an intense knowledge of literary studies, but of course also have an intimate engagement with music. So I was wondering if you'd tell us more about that.
Sure. Yeah, I think it's interesting that I kind of came into literary studies from music, or music was, maybe I should say German studies was the sort of crossroads of what my interest in music and literary studies. And so, and coming into a PhD program where in German, where I developed this project, having, you know, studied primarily music and history before that, I was always interested in, I guess I was attuned, if you will, in different ways to and particularly in this late 19th and early 20th century German literature, the presentness of music, of musical forms, of the ways that so many writers and composers were thinking beyond the bounds of their own art forms, of genres. And so I guess I was already looking and thinking about those things beforehand. When I first came upon Mahler's music, what struck me about it was how it was music, but it was so clearly telling a story. And I was so fascinated with the idea of how music can tell or speak to us, or what's its language, and how does it articulate that? And, you know, so kind of approaching it from both ways, thinking from my own experience as a musician and being interested in music, thinking about how music speaks and tells, and then from reading so much literature and engaging with it, how literary texts can evoke the musical, and often do so at the moment when words fail, and that, you know, these other artistic forms form this really interesting matrix or constellations of meaning. So I guess the kind of questions, the questions about music and sound and how they shape culture have always been in the back of my mind. And, you know, and those have remained sort of a red thread, as you might say, through my studies, thinking about how, you know, what music and sound more generally tells us about belonging and otherness, in particular cultural moments, how music has been mobilized to articulate resistance in different ways, how practices of listening, because I was interested in all of these works as well, in reception as well, about how practices of listening shape how individuals and societies view the world. So these are all kind of questions that continue to shape my work. And as far as in the practicalities of it, yes, it involves a lot of dancing between the disciplines, which is challenging. It's challenging. There's much more I could have and wanted to do in terms of musical analysis in the book. And then there were other things that I wanted to do more with the text. You know, there's always just limitations when it comes to writing a book, but I hope it opens a door and that it, you know, draws attention to some connections that people might not have thought of before. It draws attention to individuals that people might not have considered in this conversation before. And that was really my goal with this book, and you know, what will motivate my future projects as well, I think.
And with regard to your future projects, I was wondering if you could tell us some more about what projects are coming next, if there are some untouched areas or areas that you didn't have the space in the book to expand on that might find their place in another project in the future.
Yeah, well, there is one leftover project, and this isn't going to be immediately realized, but it was in an original early version of the book that I wanted to, in the kind of conclusion or final section, trace the sort of legacy, particularly of Schoenberg, Berhoffmann, and Zweig's works in the United States, and sort of the kind of experience of exile of these works, and how many of them were reimagined for German Jews in exile in New York and performed for audiences there. I was also interested in the work of Franz Werfel, who's sort of later than these writers, but who I think in his biblical dramatical works, in particular, The Eternal Road, which was his big biblical pageant that he worked on with Max Reinhardt and Kurt Weill in New York, calls upon this sort of similar idea of epic music drama that these writers and composers were conceiving. So I still hope at one point to return to that project. But sort of more immediately, I've jumped to a very different type of project, and that is I'm working with radio in post-war Germany. So the connection, while maybe tenuous, goes back to these questions about sound and acoustics and meaning making. But I've been for a long time really fascinated with the genre of radio drama. And how it emerged, particularly in post-war Germany, as a sort of unique expressive medium, how this purely acoustic medium provided a space for working through sort of the legacy of the war, of genocide, of exile, And really exploring these works, not just through the texts, and many of the texts were published and they've been studied up to this point as primarily literary works, but in uncovering the original sound documents and recordings and really thinking about what was happening, how were they being staged acoustically. And I've had the great luck to find a number of these recordings in archives in Germany. So my hope is that that will be a next project that I take on from here.
Wonderful. I'm looking forward to reading about that. And it sounds like a very exciting process of unearthing new material. So I think I've taken up enough of your time today. And I thank you so much for joining us. And it was a pleasure to hear about your recent book and about what's to come next. Thank you.
Thank you so much.